History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, invest enough time to listen as memories that may not have seen the light of day in decades start to rise to the surface again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but more often than not, we end up drawing inspiration from these stories from men and women who've put their lives on the line for the rest of us. If you're a regular listener, you might remember an episode earlier this fall in which we met a Navy Cross recipient named Harry Zinser, whose decoration might have been the Medal of Honor if not for the timing of his heroics in a helicopter behind enemy lines in Vietnam 50 years ago. When that episode aired, I mentioned that eventually we hoped to bring you the story of the jet pilot Harry was so instrumental in rescuing that night, and I'm so thrilled that we get to do that today. 77-year-old Jim Lloyd lives in the Albuquerque, New Mexico area now, but his early years were in the Golden State.
I grew up in the Walnut Creek, Pleasant Hill area. The reason I say there was two, they change us without moving one city to the other, but so I grew up in the East Bay area. I was born in Alameda. I tell everybody it was an island in the Pacific during World War II, but just barely in the war by 6 days and barely an island, but it sounds romantic. And growing up, my parents were really good to us, and my brother is a twin brother, identical brother, and we had come from a long line of identical twins. And my sister, even though she's second fiddle most of the time, was really a sweetheart even to this day. We had a good childhood. I went to college in Humboldt State in 1967. I graduated.
Hold on a second. So you said something there. You said you're from a long line of identical twins. How far back does that go? Give me the depth of that.
Well, my mother's came from six kids, and two of them were identical twins, boys, men. And then my mother had identical twins, and then my identical twin brother had identical twins, and my sister has identical twin granddaughters.
And you and your twin brother have something in common when it comes to the Vietnam War that we're going to hear about. I'm just taking a leap here. You talked about Alameda. Was your father in the Navy or something?
My dad was in the Army. He was a sergeant in the Army and on the Japanese theater, but more he spent most of his time up in the Aleutians. Then they didn't have a lot of action up there, but he spent quite a few time up there. My mom went up there to meet him, so we basically started our existence up in Canada somewhere when they met for a week of R&R during the war.
So it was World War II that brought your parents together?
They were married beforehand, barely, you know, I think about 1940, 41. But my dad went in after Pearl Harbor. I had four uncles that went in, and two of them served in World War I.
And, you know, on this program, our listeners usually hear from World War II veterans, and so I think it's interesting to get your perspective, because what we hear from these World War II vets is, you know, I didn't talk about it for 50, 60, 70 years. Did your father talk to you guys about his World War II service when you were growing up?
Not enough, because as I got older, I really have a lot of questions for him, particularly after he passed on. But he would get together with some of his friends and neighbors, and they were all veterans but one. And we would just sit there in awe just listening to them. We played Army a lot. You know, I mean, that was a big thing. We were inspired to them that we wanted to serve our country, but in our own way. We wanted to do it after college and go in and be commissioned and so forth. But they were a big inspiration to us.
You and your twin brother, did you get along pretty well? Were you rivals? How similar are the two of you?
Very similar. If he was coming to this room, he could sit down and start talking, and he'd just pick up where I left off, and you wouldn't know who you're talking to. Yeah, we were competitive, but in a good way. I wanted to finish first place in a race, but I wanted him 1 inch behind me, and he felt the same way. So that really kind of drove us, and it was a nice competition. We do that still today.
And do you remember, as you're a boy or teenager, having some idea of, hey, this is my dream when I grow up, these are the things that I want to do?
I did. That was, I love fishing. My dad got us introduced to it early on. We both became, we got our bachelor's degrees in fishery biology. And then when I got out of the Navy, I got my master's in fish disease. And yeah, we were inspired by it. I wanted to go in the military, but I didn't want to make a career out of it. I wanted to stay with my original dreams. But on that note, it was a pretty exciting 5.5 years for me, and I wouldn't trade a minute of it for anything.
But your brother was in the Army before you were in the Navy, is that right?
By 24 hours. He went in on January 8, 1968, and I went in on January 9, 1968. So we were a day apart, and then we followed each other and encouraged each other through training.
But this wasn't your plan. You mentioned you were at Humboldt State, and you were hoping to be able to finish there before having to serve in the military. What happened?
Well, I was to graduate in June of 1967 and in December of 66. We'd been student deferments, had good grades, full loads. We had the 2S deferment. And I figured in June we have to go and serve our country, but we wanted to do it as graduates. Well, in December, they changed me to 1A, which is prime beef for draft. And they sent me down for my physical, and then came back and said I'll be drafted within a few weeks. And I thought, gosh, I'll never finish. It'll be a couple of years of picking up the pieces when I get out. And the week later, the Navy came to the university looking for pilots. I had never been in an airplane in my life, not even an airliner. I took the written test. It was 3.5 hours long. They said, well, you're not obligated, but we'll send you down to Alameda if you want. And they treated me like royalty. They flew me down. I spent the weekend down there and officers club, meeting pilots and whatever, and had my orals. And then they said that you passed everything, but we're going to have to see when you're accepted and when you go in. And so, but you got to go back to school and finish, because you have to be commissioned officers to be a pilot. You have to have a degree. And so we'll get the Army off your back. So that's what happened. That's the first time the Navy saved me.
And this is where you and your brother had your paths separate?
Yeah, he took his Army physical with me. I think he made some kind of a deal with the Army that he would go in the Army and be commissioned. And so they allowed him to finish. And we both went in, like I say, early part of 68.
And I'll have you share a little bit of what happened to him. But as for you, I mean, you said that you'd never been in an airplane before. And I've had a lot of pilots talk about an initial experience that kind of got them hooked, or that they felt that spark for the first time. Did you have a moment like that where you fell in love with the idea of aviation?
Well, the time I got back in January of 67 from the physicals and so forth, it started really riding on me that, you know, I could maybe be a pilot. And I really got excited. By the time I was sworn in June, I really, really, really was smitten with the idea. I really wanted to do it. And, you know, we'd play with their little airplanes and stuff as kids, and that's the closest I've been to it. But I always was thought of need to fly. And I couldn't have been more right, so, because I really loved it.
And I guess let's take a little detour here and maybe get a nutshell sketch of what your brother went through, because he went over to Vietnam before you and was actually wounded before you were flying over there?
He was. He went over as a second lieutenant. And first of all, he finished training, became an officer in the Green Berets. But he went over the second lieutenant, and he was over there for, it was quite a while for combat, but he wanted to finish the year. But beforehand, they were ambushed, and he was shot and hauled, you know, and he was seriously injured. But he made it back, and after he was healed up and so forth, he continued for another year and a half, finishing up his tour in the Army, and then he got out 2 years before I got out of the Navy.
And I'm just curious what effect that had on you, because you talked about how close you were, how competitive you were with each other and everything. Did it give you pause? Was it sobering to know how close he had come to losing his life there?
Most definitely. The reality of being mortal and really settled in. And I guess from the other standpoint is there was a little bit of vengeance. I wanted to go back, have an opportunity to pick up where he left off and go after them for what they did to him. And that's just my own personal feeling because of being a brother. So.
And I don't want to get ahead of the story here, but you have a little picture on the wall right over here of the two of you standing in front of your twin Purple Heart license plates. And it says, Brothers Shot Up and Shot Down. What do you think of when you look at that photo?
I think how lucky we are. I think what we must have put our parents through. But we're real fortunate, you know. We try to. He lives up in Twin Falls, of all places, in Idaho, and we try to get together as much as we can. But we have all that. We're blessed that we're able to do that and still be physically capable of doing of enjoying hunting and fishing and doing things like that together, even at our age.
So let's get back to your story. So you're in the Navy now. You are getting to fly. I imagine you flew a few different aircraft before the A-7. What are some of the cockpits you got some time in?
Well, of course, with the trainers, it was a T-34 prop plane that we all flew in. We got finished with that. I flew the T-2A in basic jet training in Meridian, Mississippi for 6 months, and then went to carrier quals on the Lexington and air-to-air gunnery in the T-2B, which is the same thing with twin engine, but they were together, so we call them centerline thrust. And then I went to advanced training flying the F-9 Cougar, both the single seat and the tandem seat, for another 6 months, and they got my wings. And then I flew the A-4 for a while, the A-4 Charlie, which was a wonderful little airplane. And then I transitioned over to the A-7s, and I flew the A-7A, the A-7B, which are pretty much identical, but little upgrades. And then the A-7E, which is the when we got home from Vietnam. We flew the A-7A over in Vietnam.
And taking off and landing on a carrier is a little different from most pilots, from land-based pilots. Did that take some getting used to? Were some things that you had to feel your way through to get used to that?
It's more of the training, and I think any Navy pilot will agree with me on this. They train, and we train on a field that's simulated carrier in the daytime. And if you're not doing things right, you won't go any further than that. And then when you go out to the first time you carry a qual on the ship, in my case, as I mentioned, was the Lexington, there is a tremendous feeling of pride. And you're becoming, on that first trap, you become a member of the elite that's almost 100, but now it's 100 years old. It's just a feeling of pride. But you have to continue to do it to stay current because there's so many room for error. There's so little room for error, and particularly on a pitching deck at night.
Yeah, that's a lot can go wrong. And you would end up in a situation where even more went wrong, and there was some particular training that I know came in real handy for us. Explain to us what SEER training is and why that was so valuable for you.
SEER is Survival, Escape, Resistant, and Evasion training. It's about a week long, and if you're going into combat, you have to go through it. And they have one in Warner Springs, California for the West Coast folks, and up in Maine for the East Coast, over to Brunswick for the East Coast folks. They give you a bunch of briefing, training, and so forth, and then you're evading, and you have really soldiers chasing you. They have accents. I mean, they're Americans, but after a while, your mind plays tricks on you, and you're actually evading the enemy. And the elements are pretty tough. You haven't eaten much or hardly anything. And then they make it that you get captured, at least spend a couple days in captivity. And that never ends. We think, at night, everybody's go to bed, and you can get a little relaxation. They just change crews and keep it going. They have, in our case, they had agent yelling going all night on the speakers. And eventually, your mind gets to the point where you are in a real POW camp. And then when they figure that you've coordinated yourself enough as a group and started planning and trying to escape and this kind of stuff, they'll terminate it in a really touching way. In my case, it was they took a guy going through it, gave him an American flag, and he told him to take off running and go put it up the flagpole. And so he did that, yelling that I got the flag, I got the flag. A bunch of the guards jumped on him and started beating him, and we went and started beating the heck out of the guards. And then somebody raised the flag up the flagpole. And I remember the guy I was taking my anger out on yells up and says, salute your flag. And I looked up and the American flag's there. The national anthem comes. And then this, in our case, was an A-4 Skyhawk. Flies right over the trees at high speed. And there wasn't a dry eye in the place. And it was over with. So. But it convinced me, as many of us, I don't want to ever be captured. I couldn't imagine going through, instead of a day and a half, 8 years that some of these guys did.
And I'm just curious, while you were going through that training, which is supposed to simulate what this is really going to be like if you end up in one of these situations, how did you feel about it? It doesn't sound very comfortable or something that you would actually embrace, but more that at least I would dread. How did you feel about it while you were going through it?
The training?
Yeah.
Afraid, you don't know where it's going. You don't want to screw up. You know, you want to be there for your buddies, but it's easy to. We all made mistakes, and they grade you on it, and then you're debriefed about it. But it's something you did not look forward to. and you were glad it's behind you. And those that failed it, either physically had problems or didn't do the right thing and had to go back, I'm sure it was an awful nightmare. But they, it's geared to be a very trying, demanding, I'd say even terrible experience, but that's better there than the real thing.
Yeah, and I'm just going to ask you a real dumb, simple, straightforward question. Do you think we'd be sitting here talking to each other if you hadn't had that training?
That's a good question. I probably would have felt similarly because of, you know, my brother and I always played around with survival and with it. We Explorer Scouts was based on survival and stuff. We really enjoyed that kind of Sneaky Pete stuff. That's why he went in the Green Berets. And so I was kind of grew up with that mindset. What Sierra really helped me was, one, it could really set it deep that I was right. I don't want to get caught. But the other thing is, I there was things that I didn't know about that they taught us. And, you know, the North Vietnamese would do things that would really, really freak me out. And I knew that they expected it. And so from Sierra would taught us that. Yeah, it scared me, but it didn't surprise me. It didn't derail my thinking on that one night.
Eventually, we'll hear quite a bit about that night, that fateful night, that unforgettable night, what Jim Lloyd does not hesitate to call a miraculous night 50 years ago. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, what this decorated fighter pilot's carrier-based missions were like in Vietnam. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Jim then and now. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Purple Heart recipient Jim Lloyd, one of the rare veterans whose story we caught a little bit of before we ever met him, since we had the privilege of sitting down with one of the helicopter pilots awarded the Navy Cross for rescuing Jim from behind enemy lines in Vietnam 50 years ago. Now we get to hear Jim's incredible story, but let's build up to the most intense parts by getting a little perspective on the life of a carrier-based Navy pilot.
What was it like when you first got over there and you first started flying these combat missions off the carrier?
First of all, we were an East Coast carrier flying off the USS Saratoga. We were part of the 6th Fleet, and we were slated for our med cruise in May of 72, and we were preparing for that. Well, in early April, because North Vietnam invaded the South at a pretty intense rate, orders came down that we were going to become part of the 7th Fleet and join the other carriers over there. 5 of them were already over there. And we had 2.5 days to get ready. And we left on April 8th, I believe, or April 11th, one of those days, and took off around Africa and up to Java Sea to the waters off of Vietnam. And when we got there, I'd never obviously been anything place close to that. And I love the Philippines. It was neat, the jungles and stuff, particularly being at sea for over 30 days. After we did the practicing, we were rusty because we hadn't flown at all. The ship never stopped for flight ops. It would continue to get over there. We practiced for a few days in the Philippines, and then we went into South Vietnam and did South Vietnam combat work for a few weeks just to warm up. And down there, they had mainly 51 caliber was your enemy, and you had jungles if you went down. So, and you had South Vietnamese there, and a few military troops, Americans. Most of them had been pulled out by 72. And then we went into the North. And the North was, the South was exciting. You didn't really see a lot of anti-aircraft fire or whatever, as I mentioned, that they only had basically 51 cal. But when we got in the North, it was a whole different story. And after a four-year bombing halt, mid-68, they lifted that in the spring of 72 after the invasion. The bombing halt north of the 20th parallel allowed North Vietnam to refortify with the help of China and the Soviet Union, and they were waiting for us. It basically, you could write a movie for almost every flight you went over there. It was pretty hot.
And I have to ask what that means. What are some of the things that you encountered, some of the things that got your attention that you had to be, you know, head on a swivel to deal with?
Well, typically a flight would be an hour and a half long, and you had to be back an hour and a half because the ship obviously had to recover you, and they're turning into the wind, and if you wait very long, they're going to get out of their area, and you got one whole carrier task group waiting for one guy to get back, and that's happened a few times, but for good reason. But anyway, you would launch, and then you had about an hour in country, and then you had about 15 minutes to get back. So with that hour in country, we were a light attack. We had 500,000 and a couple of times the 2,000-pound bombs. We carried mines. We had two in the A7A, two 20-millimeter machine guns. We had two Sidewinder heat seekers for anti-aircraft. And then we also carried a Shrike missile, which is anti-radar, to help when they paint you with a Fanson radar. You would try to stick that down their throats to keep them from firing a SAM, a surface-to-air missile. But as soon as you got over the beach, generally you would start getting... your electronic countermeasure would start activating and telling you you're being painted by radar. You knew they were watching you one way or the other. We basically were shot at about every mission, some a lot more. And there would be two-plane flights going in looking for targets of opportunity or assigned targets or whatever, and you only made one pass, and there were 45 dive delivery versus 30 that we practiced at home because it was so hot over there they could knock you down. You pulled off. And you made sure you didn't go below 3,000 feet on your pull-off because your flak would get you, of the bomb ahead of you could get you, not the flak, but the shrapnel. And then also the small arms that they used, AK-47 stuff, could reach up that high. So you stayed above that, and you only made one pass. You were jinking the whole time, changing direction, altitude, because they're shooting at you. And you'd see the puffs of smoke, just like in the movies. And then you'd get sometimes you get the warble of the Fanson and radar. And then you'd have SAMs launching. And that, they, to me, were the scariest of all. Because by the time I saw the puffs of smoke or at nighttime, the flashes, it was basically behind you. I mean, it was time-wise. But a SAM, that was the beginning. And those things would travel three times the speed of sound to get to you.
Yeah, and most of us have never been in a situation like that. I'm sure a lot of people are picturing probably the most recent Top Gun movie. There's some of these phenomenon that are included in that, but you just mentioned that warble that you would hear in the cockpit. Is that something you still hear sometimes in your memory?
I do. If I tell somebody about it, I get a little apprehensive because that's a scary sound, and that's one of the last things I heard when I ejected in my headset. And it's a warble, and then you get what's called a SAM alert. It goes right, actually lights up on your canopy bow, telling you that you're being painted. And then you get a SAM launch light, and the warble goes to a very steady beat. And that, to me, is, you know, it's launched. It's airborne. It's firing its booster off to get up to you, and then you'll see it come flying up. And there, like I said, three times the speed of sound. And we had chaff. We had some gear that would help jam for it. But the SAM brake, a hard turn into it, was one of the best maneuvers because it couldn't turn with you.
And I know that the mission we're going to spend a lot of time talking about on August 6th, 1972, was supposed to be your 100th carrier landing. So, I mean, in the first 99, there must have been some other close calls, probably plenty of times where you heard that noise in the cockpit that puts you on alert. Are there some things that stand out for you in those first 99 carrier takeoffs and landings?
The carrier takeoff and landings, of course, you were really acute. Your mindset was very, very focused. If you backed off at all, you might not make it. But the carrier landing was very, very demanding. And particularly the A7 was similarly to the F-8 Crusader, similar design. It was clean when it came in because And that made it tough to slow down without getting too slow. But anyway, we got it all figured out. That was fine. But one mission that really stands out is we were on an Alpha Strike, and that's like a 30-35 plane that's going after a major military industry or whatever it was. And it was a coordinated strike with fighters holding up for MiGs and SAM suppressors and so forth. So it was really coordinated, but they saw you coming. And we pulled in at a target near Hai Duong, up not too far from Hanoi. And as we pulled off, we were carrying, I think we were carrying 80 Mark 83s. That's 6,000 pounders. And they're dragged. They're outside the airplane, obviously. And so when they come off, you get all that weight and that drag stopped instantly, and you really could be respond. And then with the A7, we'd switch to guns and missiles in case we'd be subsonic planes for possible MiG threat. I went to pull off, and nothing happened, and nothing came off. And of course, the rest of the flight left me. They were accelerating while I was deaccelerating. Every time I jink, I'd lose altitude and speed, and with all that weight and drag, and my guns, nothing worked. And so I called up the major, the leader of the Alpha Strike, and he said, I got two Phantoms coming back. Just then I heard Red Crown, which was our one of the destroyers, saying we got bandits at such and such, and that was right where I was. And they usually went after lame ducks anyway. And so I never saw them, but they went behind me. Unfortunately, one of the Phantoms that came back for me was ready to shoot down the lead MiG when he got shot by the MiG's wingman. I went down, he became a POW, they both of them did. And I did make it to the water, and was able to play around with the switches and stuff and get off enough, jettison enough to land on the carrier. But I thought I was gone. I couldn't defend myself, I couldn't maneuver to defend myself, but it worked out for me.
And when we hear the saga of August 6th, we're gonna hear how many people put their lives on the line to save yours. But just in this story, you're talking about two F-4s that came to your rescue and paid a price, not quite the ultimate price, but a pretty heavy price, so you could get home. What did that mean to you at the time?
Well, I felt really bad about it. I felt that, it might have happened anyway, even if I wasn't there, because the MiGs were airborne going after the flight group, and then they just focused on me. But I felt terrible about it. I'm glad they survived. We somehow knew that they were captured and not killed when they got hit. In that case, they probably were POWs about 8 or 9 months, because the war ended the following year. But at the time, when you're young, we lost a lot of people, and you miss them and feel bad about it, but you keep looking, you're still vulnerable, and you sort of keep thinking about that. Yeah, I would survive that one, but what about tomorrow morning or tomorrow night or whatever?
And I know the what-if questions are tough, but just so we have the right perspective, what do you think would have happened to you? Because you couldn't defend yourself, you said. You couldn't get rid of those bombs. You couldn't fly the way you wanted to. What would have happened to you if those F-4s hadn't come back to protect you?
No doubt in my mind, I would have been hit and gone in. Whether I survived that or not, I can't say. But I was prime beef for them. I was an easy kill.
And does that, when you survive something like that, when you make it back to the carrier after something like that, does that affect your perspective moving forward?
Yes. It doesn't take long into the cruise to realize that you're vulnerable. We always thought that death, or I did anyway, death was for the alien or the elderly. And then you start realizing that it's very possible for anybody. Yeah, you just have to keep looking ahead so that it doesn't overwhelm you. Afterwards, as the years went on, we get home, I keep thinking back of that more and more. Fortunately, most of these fighter guys, I look back on them. By the time I really started feeling, and analyzing it and doing this, I realized that they were, repatriated. So that was good.
And we're going to hear about the mission that is the reason there's a Purple Heart on your wall over here, but there's also a Bronze Star that has the Combat V device for Valor. Was that one of those first 99?
No, that was for the results of August 6th. Yes. The way the Navy looks at it, and I fully agree and understand, is that I basically, with my actions, I saved the Navy pilot, even though it happened to be me. And so I got the Combat Action Ribbon, the Purple Heart, and the Bronze Star with a V.
And just don't want to miss anything important or relevant here. So of those first 99, takeoffs, landings, everything in between, which you described so well. Were there some missions where you brought that A-7 back in with damage a time or two?
Well, one of, actually it was in South Vietnam where I didn't expect to have any trouble. There's a piece of equipment that hangs out. It's like a vane, and it moves in the relative wind, and that controls your, not to get technical, but the angle of attack. It's your attitude of your nose, and it controls your speed, and it's real critical to watch. You use that when you're landing on a ship because you want to be within a, you know, as close as a knot as possible to a knot, your airspeed mile per hour as possible. And it changes all the time with your weight change as you burn fuel. I had it shot off and it jammed to the full stall position. Well, I wasn't stalling. I was doing 400 and some odd knots. And incidentally, a knot's about 1.1 mile per hour. But it jammed it and it told the airplane I was stalling. So this airplane automatically goes in a rudder shaker. So that gets your attention. So I flew about almost an hour to get back to the ship with rudder shaker, and I was pretty well numb to the waist by the time I landed.
I'm surprised your brain wasn't completely scrambled after that.
I didn't want to bring that up, but you're probably right, it was.
And most of us have never or will never be in the cockpit of an A-7. So what was that plane like to fly? What did you appreciate about it, or what were the features that stood out?
Well, I'll compare that to the A-4 that I flew before. The A-4 was a small airplane, and that was really a gem. I loved it, but it was tight. I had to have the seat way down. I'm 6'2", and my head would sometimes still bounce on the canopy. But you could reach anywhere in the cockpit and find whatever you needed. The A-7, I call that the A-4 a sports car. The A-7 was the Cadillac. And it was it had made major improvements the way it fulfilled its mission. And it was almost magic the way it was so accurate and what it did. But it was a lot roomier and a lot, I thought, for me, a lot more comfortable. But one of the negative things about it is, I applied earlier, it was a little hard to land on a carrier compared to the A-4 because most airplanes have speed brakes out, full flaps, large gear, landing gear, and there's a lot of drag. So if you get a little fast, you pull the power back, and it slows down right where you want it. Put the power back on, and you're in business. The A-7 had an 11-foot speed brake that went down, it opened up. It was like the F-8, and it really slowed you down. And then when you lower the landing gear, there were little tiny landing gear. And then when they landed, the speed brake automatically retracted or you land on it. So you came in pretty slick. You'd be coming in, and if you're going a little too fast, you pull back power, and it would keep gliding, and you pull back a little more. And, of course, the LSO, the landing signal officer, is watching you, and the A-7 smoked a lot. So in the daytime, they could tell when you're reducing power, and they tell you don't pull under power. It's better to bolter, which means go over the wires, than to get a ramp strike, obviously. And then if you're not careful, you'd be just about catching up to the speed you want, slowing down, but you're under power to do it, and you hit the verbal wind coming over the deck from the island, and it would throw you, it was a downwash. And so right at the worst time, you would get that, and you could do a ramp strike a little easier than I think you would in some of the other airplanes. And the F-8, keep bringing it up because it's designed after it, had a share of ramp strikes, particularly at night on a pitching deck. If you're coming down underpowered and the ship's going up on a swale, it doesn't take much imagination to imagine what's going to happen.
No, it doesn't. But Jim Lloyd endured something quite a bit hairier than those tricky carrier landings, getting shot down behind enemy lines in Vietnam. We'll hear about that terrifying moment and some of the miracles that followed when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go.
Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number 800-989-1139.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd of New Mexico. In a moment, he's going to start describing the most unforgettable night of his life, August 6th, 1972. It would be the 100th time he took off from an aircraft carrier for a mission. And since he was giving us a feel for some of the things that can go wrong when taking off or landing on an aircraft carrier, I have to at least ask the question, right?
All 99 of those leading up to your 100th mission were just flawless? Carrier landings, night, day, whenever? You did them all perfectly?
Oh, if I said that, any Navy pilot sitting in the audience would laugh at me. No, you have your time. I didn't do any dangerous landings, but, I bolted a few times. And it's like I say, that's when you fly over the wires. And you might get a hook skip that does that, and that's not your fault. But if you're a little overpowered, yeah, you can bolt. Then you got to just come around and do it again. You get your share of those. You get wave-offs. I don't remember having too many of those for my performance, but sometimes the plane ahead of you is slow getting out of the wires and the wave you, it's called a foul deck wave off. But I'm sure I had a few wave offs, for not being set up right and whatever. But if you get an okay pass, that's the best you can get is the okay. There's nothing better than that. And if it's enough control, changing in attitude, changing in direction, and speed like that, they'll downgrade it to a fair, which fair pass is all right. It's safe. And there's worse ones than that, but okay with no comment is the best you can get. And I had a few of those that I really like, make you feel good. But it depends on the situation. Sometimes you're really psyched, being shot at really bad, or you lost somebody on that flight. You're coming back and you're shook up. The deck is pitching, and it might be 2 in the morning. Visibility is poor. You got a lot of things against you. So having perfect passes is something you dream about, and hope for. But it don't happen all the time.
And you made reference to something there that I wanted to touch on before we get into August 6th of 72. You mentioned coming back and maybe you lost somebody that day. I was interested to know what your relationship was like with the other pilots in your squadron or other people you interacted with aboard ship.
Even by the end of the 10.5 month cruise, I didn't know everybody really well. I could identify everybody, but I didn't know the other squadrons in the air wing. But I had a lot of friends in the different squadrons. And of course, our squadron, you come really close to. You're living with them right there in the same quarters in that particular part of the ship. When you lose somebody, it's really hard on you. And you realize once you lose somebody that, it could happen. Even, it was over 50 years ago, and I think of those people, and I still find it very upsetting knowing that they never got past their 20s.
And of course, there's one spot in Washington, D.C. that so many Vietnam veterans have gone to, and now the honor flights from all over the country, including here in northern New Mexico, are taking veterans back to see things like that. Is that something where a guy that you lost, you've gone to the wall and you've looked at his name, you've thought about him?
Part of my career, I spent several years in D.C., and yes, we go to the wall. The feeling I got is when I'd see the name there of one of my friends, it just set deeply the permanency of it, that it is real. It's just not something I dreamt about, or maybe he made it or whatever, and I just didn't remember it right or whatever. But any slim as it was, hope that the person wasn't killed is confirmed, and seeing the name was emotional.
And I don't want to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth, but after we hear the story of August 6th of 1972, I'm sure a lot of people listening are going to say, man, his name easily could have been on that wall about 50 different times during that night. Is that something you've ever consciously thought when you're at the wall?
Yeah, I thought of that. I thought, what if I, of course, I could have been on the wall and wouldn't be there looking at it, but the part I get about it is I think, what if it was my brother on the wall? Because he had obviously a close call. And we're just both so grateful that we're not.
Well, so unless there's something else you want to throw in beforehand, let's hear that the incredible I don't know what you'd call it, ordeal that you endured on August 6th of 1972, because there's so many little details that could have changed the whole story. How did that day start, and take us through it from start to finish?
I can't recall what mission I had during the day, but I had a mission over there, and I was getting ready for a night mission, and this other pilot and I were assigned to go after enemy trucks that were reported up near the Vinson area in North Vietnam that were moving supplies south. As we were getting ready to go, the guy I was with, his plane went down, had mechanical problems. So they launched me anyway, but they wouldn't set a single-seat aircraft over the north by himself for obvious reasons. Another section, which is a two-plane formation from our carrier, launched. I was getting ready to launch, and the flight leader of that, I'm going to mention names, Lieutenant Commander Art Bell, who was an absolutely superb combat pilot. His wingman went down on the carrier for also mechanical problems, so they launched him, and they asked me to join him. And so we went after the trucks together, and frankly speaking, that was the first miracle, because of what Art did and was able to do, I don't think most pilots could, and locating where I was. So anyway, we by the time we went, we call feet dry into North Vietnam, it was dark. We got up to the area. The AAA, the anti-aircraft fire was spotty, and I thought this is going to be a piece of cake. We'll be done in an hour and get back to the ship and watch a movie, take a shower, get a bite to eat before going hitting the rack. I rolled in on a 45 dive delivery, and incidentally, when you're flying at night, at least back in those days, you obviously have your lights off, and you can't see each other either. So you talk to each other and keep tabs. Try to keep quite a bit of separation for obvious reasons. So I'm not sure if he was facing away or facing toward me. I rolled in and I pulled off, and I rolled over to evaluate my hit so I could report it to the ship when I got back. When I got the bomb was going off on the trucks, and I got an indication in the cockpit of it being painted by the Fansong. I got the warble. I got the SAM alert light, and then it changed to the warble. And then I looked off to the distance in the direction that it was pointing to, and I could see about 10 miles away a big fireball arcing up to the dark sky and coming toward me. And I tell people, remind them that at night the human eye doesn't have very good depth perception, and if I turn too soon, it would give the SAM, it's coming up now three times the speed of sound, an opportunity to arc with me. And if I waited too late to do it, it had a 500-foot kill radius, and so I might have been caught in that radius. And so, and I was pumping shaft to confuse the radar, but when I saw this fireball just kept coming up at me, I could see a dark center in the middle of the fireball, which was the nose cone. I figured it's time to break. So I did break, and I could feel it screaming by me, missing me. But what I didn't know is they fired another SAM from behind, and my ECM gear that it was making the noises was going to give you just one indication if it's one or more, and I didn't know about it. And it blew up next to me, and it took off my left wing. The plane immediately went into a nose down, falling. I realized I got to get out, and we have a face curtain we pull down. And that's the preferred method because it straightens your back, and it protects your face. Or if you're real, got to get out now and can't take your hands off the controls, you just pull the D-ring that's between your legs. I pulled it, and it seemed like forever, as nothing happened. Well, it was my state of mind, because in 0.2 seconds, the system sequence started, the canopy blew, and I started going up the rails. But what happened in my mind is I looked down to see if it hung up on my entered blackout suit, on my G-suit, and then the seat fired, and so I didn't realize it at the time, but they gave me a double break up compression fracture of the neck when I went out. As I left, all I remember is a sudden rush of air, the red instrument lights pulling away, then a second or two later, the plane blowing up, and I went horizontally over right at the edge of the fireball, swung twice, and landed at a big hard landing, but I landed and didn't break anything.
Just one quick question there. You said something I want to zoom in on here. Right after you ejected, the plane blew up. So if you had waited another second or two to pull that D-ring, you wouldn't be here?
I wouldn't be there. Even if I got out, then I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat. I mean, they're tremendous seats, and the engineers that put them and design them together and put them together do a tremendous job, but they got their limits. You got to give it a little bit of a opportunity for it to get you out. And a guy my size, 185 pounds, 6'2", is probably 200 feet, 250 feet. It blows you up if you're just sitting on the ground. So it's a pretty good kick in the seat. And then you got air bladders that push you away from the mechanical metal seat as you come out, and then your parachute opens if you're below 13,500 feet automatically. You try to beat it in case there's a malfunction, but it happens so fast. They're miracles, those seats. They get you out.
What was your estimated altitude when you ejected?
Well, all I remember is seeing 2,000 feet screaming through the altimeter, and that'd be 2,000 feet above sea level. I have no idea about how high off the ground. I'm guessing it might be anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred feet, the elevation of the ground. There wasn't any mountains below me. It was all open rice paddies and fields. So I was probably around a little less than 2,000 feet above the ground when I got out, but things happen so fast.
And that's less than ideal.
Less than ideal. I actually, looking back, I thought I'd be out of the safety envelope of the seat.
And so you said you swung twice and hit the ground.
I hit the ground on a swing and knocked the wind out of myself. I don't remember getting out of my parachute, my helmet, or the seat pan. That's the survival pan that stays with you after you separate from the metal seat. And I just remember running. The fireball was right there, so it was cooking off the 200 millimeter. My two machine guns were popping off. I was afraid of any of the surviving 500-pound bombs that go off, which got a 3,000-foot kill radius, so I had to get away from those. And then also, the light of it was just giving me away. And as I ran, I have no idea how far I went. I got down behind a little clump of what I refer to as razor grass. It was real sharp grass, about 2-3 feet high, and squatted in it and just sort of tried to assess the situation. There was literally 100, if not more, North Vietnamese coming out of the village just screaming and yelling. And I have no idea how many were the paramilitia, how many were villagers, and a lot of the villagers were armed anyway, and how many were the soldiers. But they were all over the place in the open fields. But it was very, very dark. Another miracle for me. And I got behind this little clump of grass and tried to assess the situation. I put mud on my hands and face to cut the skin tones, and also the mosquitoes were terrible. I remember I thought I saw flashlights coming, and one flashlight would be over with. But there were fireflies, big fireflies up close, and I was thinking it might be lights in the distance. And talk about a relief. So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up and told him I was alive. He said, Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one. And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and I Mike did keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, okay, you're overhead now. And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, satellite imagery, or any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn him back. I'll have to call him one in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane, it's comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, and a shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around.
So with that in mind, how in the world is he still with us? We're going to hear it in Jim Lloyd's own words, but we're going to have to wait till next time because time has run out on this episode of Hometown Heroes. How many more miracles did Jim experience on August 6, 1972? And what kind of perspective has it given him 50 years later? Don't forget to visit hometownheroesradio.com for photos of Jim then and now. And join us again next time for the rest of his story when we'll see and hear even more clearly that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.